Many of you have asked us for a longer podcast, a full version of each Sci-Fi show. Well, we heard you, and now you can listen to each full show. No need to have to keep juggling and clicking to the next section. It will come up automatically, just like on the radio. You'll hear the billboard at the top letting you know what's coming up, should you wish to fast forward. So here we go. Hope you enjoy Science Friday. A new study says that radiation from cell phone use can affect the brain, but researchers are not sure yet whether the brain activity produced by the radiation is good, bad, or insignificant. We'll talk with study author Nora Volkov about the research. We'll also hear about a new view of how neurons operate in the brain. It's not the way you were taught in school. Plus, a scientist finds a way to create an out-of-body experience and to trick his research subjects into believing that they had three arms. And finally, the video pick. How can our eyes move 100,000 times a day, but we don't see a blur? Some answers in your questions after this break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, your brain on cell phones. But first, speaking about your brain, think back to biology class when you learned about the brain and nerve cells. Remember those cells had long wire-like tentacles carrying electric signals to and from the cell? The axon. Yeah, the axon carried the impulses away. You remember the A for axon and away. And signals coming into the neurons from the dendrites. Dendrites evaluate. And they evaluate whether to respond with that information. And if they do, a split second later, the signal fires and an impulse goes down away on the axon. Sounds pretty straightforward, right? Basic biology 101. But a recent study in the journal Nature Neuroscience says it may not be so simple, that some neurons may respond not right after a simulation, but significantly later. And what's more, in some cases, a signal can go the other way, up the axon. And axons can talk to other axons in some mysterious way. Wow. Joining me now to talk about it is Nelson Spruston. He's one of the authors of that paper and a professor of neurobiology and physiology at Northwestern University in Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Wow, interesting new kinds of stuff about the way neurons work.
Yeah, well, this really fascinated us when we made this discovery. My graduate student, Mark Sheffield, came to me one day, I still remember the day, and said, "Look what's happening here. I don't understand this." And it took us a while to figure it out, but it definitely did change the way that we think about how these particular neurons are functioning.
So he really discovered, he looked at something people had seen over the years and thought it was something wrong with the experiment.
That's right. We think that probably one of the reasons it's been overlooked is people thought that something was wrong with either the cell being unhealthy or the quality of the recording conditions not being right. But Mark had the insight to realize that everything looked okay, and that if he stimulated the neuron the same way over and over again, he would get the same kind of unusual response. And you wouldn't expect that from a cell that was unhealthy. It would start to deteriorate and not produce a reliable response.
So let's talk about these things as individual events and separate them out. First, give us one and what was surprising about it.
Well, there's two aspects of the findings that were really surprising to us, and one has to do with time and one has to do with space. So as you nicely described, neurons respond rapidly to incoming signals. And if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense that it would happen that way. If you're an animal that wants to escape from a predator, you don't want to wait around for a long time. So neurons were built really to perform very rapid signaling. And this is the way we usually think about how things work. But the thing that we noticed about these responses is they generated a form of response that seemed to be sensitive to what was happening with stimulation on this time scale of a minute or 2 minutes. So if you stimulated the neuron repeatedly for a couple of minutes, it would go into another state of firing.
There would be a big delay between the stimulation and the response.
Yeah, that's right. So a minute or two of stimulation, and then suddenly, with a very rapid onset, the neuron would begin responding in this very long fashion. So again, the output would last for a long time, about a minute or so. And the firing, when we talk about firing, we're talking about action potentials in axons. And those action potentials had some very unusual characteristics as well that led us to believe the neuron was in a different state than the conventional state where it's responding rapidly to a stimulus that's arriving.
And what about the idea that the pulses in the axons can go in different directions?
Yeah, so that's where the idea of space comes in. As you nicely described at the top of the program, the way we usually think about it is the dendrites are the receiving structure of the neuron and the axon is the output structure. In this case, because of the unusual nature of the signals that we recorded during this persistent firing state, we thought that the action potentials were likely coming from the axon. And it looked to us like the axon was actually integrating the stimulus over this period of a minute or two that leads up to the persistent firing. So it looks like the axon in this particular behavioral state of the neuron is functioning both as an input structure and an output structure.
Wow, no wonder you always thought there was something wrong with the measurement, because this is so unusual.
Yeah, so it took quite a bit of work, actually, to really understand what we were seeing. So we had some insights, both from experiments that we had done in the past, as well as computational modeling. And one of my colleagues, Bill Kath, and I worked together a lot on making computer models of neurons. And computer modeling of neurons, I think, is a really powerful approach, and it allows us to see things or recognize things as unusual that we might not otherwise pick up when we're doing the experiments.
Now let's talk about this third aspect, which is it appears that axons are talking to one another.
Right. So this was perhaps the most surprising aspect of our work was we did recordings from pairs of these particular types of neurons that exhibit persistent firing. And we found that in some cases, when we stimulated one neuron, one of the two that we were recording from, the other one, the unstimulated one, would go into this persistent firing state. And there were none of the usual indications that the two neurons were connected in a conventional way by synaptic connections. And so we think we've identified an unusual form of communication that occurs between the axons of these neurons.
So how do they – spooky action at a distance, like the physicists would call it? I mean, how would they connect?
There's got to be a physical substrate for the interaction, of course. One possibility is that the axons are connected by structures called gap junctions. That's an idea that has been proposed in the past. Another possibility is that there are actually synaptic connections between the axons themselves, although we think that that's unlikely. We still need to do a lot more work to really understand this, but we think it's unlikely that there are synaptic connections. The third possibility is that there's some sort of intermediate structure. So, for example, a non-neuronal cell or a glial cell in the system is responding to stimulation of one cell and then generating a signal to which other cells in the immediate vicinity could respond.
So even after all these years of studying nerve cells and brain cells, there may still be structure there that we have not discovered.
Yeah, that's really the amazing thing, and I think it really highlights the need for this kind of research. I mean, we have to really understand how the component parts of the brain function if we want to understand how neural circuits function, how they control behavior, and what goes wrong in various diseases. I think we really have to be doing basic research, and sometimes findings like this really take you by surprise and make you realize, wow, we really understand things a lot less than we may have thought.
Isn't science like that?
It is. It's what makes it exciting, actually. It's what makes it fun to do science.
I understand that, but the idea that there may be diseases connected to this, there may be a new mechanism for neuronal disease or brain disease or dysfunction that we never thought about might be somehow locked up in a structure we never knew about.
That's right. I mean, I think that when people go looking for causes of diseases or, let's say, neuronal manifestations of neurological and psychiatric disorders, you think about that in terms that you understand, in the way that we know how neurons function and how they communicate with each other. For example, Alzheimer's disease is thought to be a disease that affects the synapses, the connections between neurons. If there are unknown forms of communication, then we have really no way of identifying that those forms of communication might be involved in diseases. And there are lots of candidate diseases for this particular part of the brain that we're studying. And maybe this is a contributing factor.
What kinds of diseases might that?
So the two diseases, neurological diseases that affect the hippocampus the most are most commonly are epilepsy and Alzheimer's disease. There are also psychiatric diseases like schizophrenia, depression, and anxiety. The hippocampus has been implicated in being involved in all of those diseases. And again, if we want to understand how this structure, the hippocampus itself, is affected by disease, we need to understand in great detail how the individual neurons work and what the molecular mechanisms are for the various types of behavior that they exhibit.
You keep saying we need to understand. How do we proceed?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of different approaches in neuroscience. There's a lot of fancy, expensive equipment. There's new developments in technology that are truly fascinating. But I think the most powerful approach that we have is collaboration. I think that the brain is such an incredibly complex organism that there's no single approach that is going to solve the problem. And I think that bringing together smart people with different approaches to studying the brain, some studying its structural features, some studying its functional or physiological features, others studying its molecular composition. Having those people collaborate together, I think, is the key to trying to understand how the brain works. And I mentioned before the power of computational modeling. I think what we need to do in neuroscience is bring together facts that have been learned from experiments of different types and bring them together and integrate those findings in the form of computational models. And for example, you know, the NIH has supported the work that we've done in part through a program that is designed to bring together people doing experiments and people doing computational modeling. So it's a joint effort by the NIH and the NSF to try to really get people bringing together information from various types of experimental approaches and bring them together specifically in computer models.
And a computer model, briefly, is trying to model how the brain works, but on a computer.
That's right. And you can do that on many different levels. So, for example, you could make a computer model of a large circuit of neurons. You could make a computer model of an individual neuron. You can even make computer models of small parts of neurons. And the idea is to bring together knowledge in a very quantitative fashion. You know, you think you can understand that doing X causes Y in a neuron. Well, now do you have a system of quantitative equations that can really explain that behavior in a reliable fashion? And as I mentioned before, sometimes because these models become very, very complicated, they sometimes lead to surprising behavior that's unexpected. And when you see that unexpected behavior, it allows you to identify new experiments that you might never have thought of otherwise.
Oh. Well, Dr. Spruson, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today, and good luck to you.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nelson Spruson, professor of neurobiology and physiology at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Take a quick break. We'll be coming back to talk more about the brain, this time your cell phone on your brain. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There has been much talk about whether cell phones may have some deleterious effect on our brains, from the radio waves coming out of the antenna being held right up against your head. Well, studies have gone back and forth on whether or not cell phone use could be a health risk, with the most in the industry saying that it has no proven ill effects. Just this week, a study published in the journal Bioelectromagnetics reported no statistically significant change in the incidence of brain cancers in men and women in England between 1998 and 2007, a time when cell phone use increased dramatically. But now, new work published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association says there is an identifiable effect of cell phone use in the brain, but it's really too early to tell what, if anything, that effect means health-wise. Joining me now to talk about it is Dr. Nora Volkov. She's director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH and one of the authors of the JAMA paper. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me here. How are you?
How are you?
I'm good. And you?
I'm fine. Can you tell us what actually was seen happening in the brain?
Well, the study was done to try to answer that question. Is the human brain sensitive or not to the weak electromagnetic radiation that is delivered from cell phones when you place them by the side of your ear? And we use positron emission tomography to measure brain glucose metabolism, which serves as an indicator of brain function because when the brain is activated, glucose metabolism goes up. And what we found was when we compared images of the brain when subjects had their cell phones, the right cell phone activated versus when they had the cell phones unactivated, there was a significant increase in brain glucose metabolism in the area of the brain near the antenna, which indicates that indeed the human brain is sensitive to the electromagnetic radiation emitted from cell phones.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen the glucose activity, meaning something is happening, but you don't know what is happening.
What we don't know, first of all, we do not know what is the mechanism that is leading to the increase in glucose consumption, glucose metabolism. We interpret it to mean that the brain is activated because that's what happens when cells are activated. They increase the consumption of glucose. But how is that brought about? There's been a lot of controversy, for example, of whether cell phones could increase temperature of the brain, which in turn could affect energy requirements. Alternatively, others have said, could it be that you are changing the electrical gradients across the membrane that makes cells much more excitable, or whether you are disrupting blood-brain barrier? The mechanism, we do not know. And also, the other issue that we don't know, which is the one that has generated the most interest, is how does this relate, for example, to the question of whether cell phones have or don't have potential deleterious effects to the brain. And based on our study, which documents that it's sensitive, we really cannot infer whether this is a bad or could even have a potentially good application. So that our finding does not illuminate or enlighten that very important question of whether cell phone exposure could have detrimental effects. What it does tell, I mean, in looking at the data in my brain certainly, is that we do have the obligation to evaluate whether there are long-term consequences from this exposure to electromagnetic radiation or not. But we need to evaluate it in such a way as to be able to answer this question.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking with Dr. Nora Volkov of the National Institutes of Health. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And Dr. Volkov, it's interesting that you say, I hear you saying, we need to have now further studies to find out what's going on there.
Yes, indeed. And I think that we need to me, the most important one, and that's the one that we as a research team would like to pursue, is what are the consequences of repeated stimulation of this type into the brain, say, after 10, 15 years? Are there long-lasting changes? Or is this just an acute effect that once a cell phone exposure is interrupted, it has no consequences at all? So, and there are no answers for that particular question. We do not know.
How long, just in your study, how long was the cell phone exposed? Did people have the cell phone up to the ears?
50 minutes.
50 minutes. And did the effect go away immediately when the cell phone was removed?
Well, we didn't study that because the way that we conducted the study, we only get one measurement. Mm-hmm. So the measurement was being done the last 20. So the cell phone was activated 30 minutes before we injected the radioactive glucose, and then it was continued for 20 minutes. So what we actually saw in terms of brain glucose metabolism was the effects of having the cell phone stimulating your brain. But it would be, of course, very interesting to evaluate, say, for example, 10 or 15 minutes. Has metabolism go back to its previous state, or does it stay activated for a longer period of time? Unfortunately, our study cannot answer that question.
But you're saying those are the kinds of studies that need to be now started.
Or no, absolutely, and I mean, even if it's say, for example, stays, I put my cell phone and I get activated for 2 or 3 hours after it discontinues. Suppose I'm fantasizing that that's what happens because I don't know if it does or if it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But the issue that to me is interesting, but the most important question is, does it start to change the way that the brain functions in ways that it does not recover? That is, to me, the question that would worry me if there is a long-lasting effect that persists after the exposure has long gone in ways that could be detrimental to the function of the brain. And that there is no data to indicate that that is the case, but also there's no data to indicate to us that we have evidence that that's not going to happen. And those studies should be done.
How would you do that? What would the protocol be like? Would you follow the same people, or do you just do sort of a population-wide study?
It's a very difficult study to do, and I think that in your question you're already hinting at that. First of all, you're not going to be able to do a randomized trial, which is the ideal experimental protocol to address if there are differences between metabolism in subjects that you're following prospectively that are exposed versus those that are not. That is a very unrealistic study. Nonetheless, within the constraints that one has, certainly you would like to, for example, ideally be able to do a prospective study that follows individuals at one point in time in terms, for example, of brain glucose metabolism or activation patterns using other technologies, and then you follow them and assess if the areas of the brain which are the ones that are receiving the highest amount of electromagnetic radiation and do show the changes versus a control area that's far away. And this is actually plausible for two things. One of them is we all tend to use our cell phones in general on the same side of the head, and we all tend to use it as to place the upper part in our ear and the lower part towards our mouth. So based on the cell phone model that you're using, you can very much estimate where the antenna is located and which are the areas that are going to be affected. Mm-hmm. So one could take that difference, for example, of laterality and of placement within the brain in a prospective design. It's not trivial because cell phone technology changes, and one of the things, for example, that in the meantime people say, well, how are you using this information to give recommendations to others? Is it of any value? And I said, well, it obviously will depend on the degree of uncertainty that you're willing to take. I'm very conservative with uncertainty on my brain, but that's my own neurosis. So well, I, as a result of this, I do use an earpiece that I attach to the cell phone, or I use the speakerphone. And this, to me, is such a trivial solution. So yeah. I say, well, why not? It allows me to keep on using my cell phone. And at the same time, it deals with my neurosis of being unable to really tolerate the notion that there could be any deleterious action. I'm neurotic.
Yeah, we all are. And, you know, let me just think outside the box for a second with you here, if you'll indulge me. Let's say you had a device. It's not a cell phone. You had a device, and you were a company that made medical devices. And you had a device that you put up to someone's ear, and it stimulated some change in the brain. And you can show that there was a change in the brain. And you wanted to market this device. Wouldn't you have to prove to the FDA or whoever it is, the Consumer Product Safety Division, that whatever device was creating this change in your brain had to be safe before you could market it?
Yes, you have to prove that the device is not going to cause damage to your patients, just like you do also, of course, for medication. The issue that becomes more problematic is you design trials to try to address that question within a certain period of time. So say, for example, that I do have a device, and I think that if there is evidence that this weak electromagnetic radiation does not have any untoward effects, I think it is a valid question to try to do research to determine if there are potential therapeutic applications. So if I do a study and I follow my subject, say, for example, for 12 months or 24 months, does that really answer the question properly? And it may be that it's not until I have followed them for 5 or 10 years,
right,
as the brain becomes also older, because what you may not see in a young brain that has much more resilience may become much more sensitive as the individual becomes older and has a cumulative effect from the exposure to that particular device.
I guess what I'm asking is, if you have discovered that there is a device that affects the functioning of your brain, and we don't know how that effect really is over the long term, isn't it up to the people who make the device, because it does affect our brain like it would be any other medical device, to first prove before they can sell it to me that it doesn't have any deleterious effect?
But right now, someone that is in the manufacturing company could come to you and say, prove to me that there's any harmful effects of cell phones. The cell phone technology has exploded, and there's really no clear-cut evidence of any harmful effects. And if there were harmful effects, because there are so many people exposed to it, it could have already become evident. So when you are in that paradigm where you can never completely rule out on one way or the other, and again, this issue has been going back and forth with respect to whether cell phone exposures are safe or not. To me, and that's why I reiterate, our finding in no way clarifies that whole controversial issue. Because activation of the brain in and of itself is not something negative. It's physiological. I am activating several areas of my brain. You want me to activate them because otherwise I wouldn't be functioning properly. I'm thinking what I'm going to tell you. And so my whole frontal cortex is probably using glucose metabolism. The areas of the brain, auditory cortex, are using glucose metabolism. So this, and probably increasing metabolism as much or perhaps even more in some instances to what we observe with the cell phone stimulation. The difference is that it's a physiological activation as opposed to what you see with a cell phone exposure. And we don't know, I mean, and we really literally do not know if this is in any way negative at all or not.
Mm-hmm. Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday on NPR. Talking with Dr. Nora Volkoff. Sorry, doctor, to interrupt. Go ahead.
No problem. No. But I'm also listening very clearly to your question of should manufacturers of technology not prove to us that they are safe? And again, this also depends on what are the threshold of safety and what are the regulations.
Yeah.
And I think that this is going to, as a society, may force us to view what is it that's going to be acceptable in terms of risk for technology and what's unacceptable. Because let's take a car. I mean, cars kill is the number one cause of deaths among young people. Great technology. There are clear-cut risks, and yet we accept them. So I think that the issue here that is different is we don't understand, we don't really know that sense that this is a type of energy that we have not properly investigated with respect to consequences on the brain or perhaps even other tissues of our body.
And who should do the investigation? Should it be the cell phone companies or should it be the federal government, your division doing that?
Well, if you are running a company and you have to basically get sufficient revenue in order to survive, you have to make decisions of what you are going to do in order to maximize your profits and minimize your risks. And you do realize that you want to have a safe product because otherwise that could kill you. So it's like anything else, making a balance. And that's where also the government has played an extraordinary important role in providing the infrastructure to address research questions that pertain to the health of all of us. So I don't know that one could come up with a recipe of who should be responsible. Ultimately, I think both the companies as well as governments are responsible to provide with knowledge and information that can allow individuals to make decisions about what is healthy and what they should try to avoid.
As I said before, if you want to create a medical product or a drug or a product or something, you have to prove that it's safe before you can sell it, don't you?
Correct, and that's something that we're always – and you can have a medication, they prove that it's safe within, say, a trial that's done over 2 or 3 years later. And then they found 10 years later that when they look back, there's a much greater incidence of stroke. But stroke being such, in this case, a low frequency, you were not able to detect it during the first 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. So that's where you also see that it's not foolproof. I think that it's a system that helps, but we have to recognize also that there are limitations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you come down on saying you're very conservative. I'm going to be wearing my Bluetooth instead of my cell phone on my ear.
I'm not saying Bluetooth. I'm saying
Do we know that Bluetooth is any better?
I don't know. That's why I don't know. And I'm using one of these wire earpiece.
So should we put a Bluetooth in the PET scanner?
Well, I think that is an important question. I mean, it depends which next question you want to answer.
Well, let's go with that one first. I have about a minute before the break. We'll continue it. But should we, since you put the cell phone in there, now should we try a Bluetooth and see what happens?
We could do that Bluetooth, or we could do the question you asked me. Well, once you interrupt the cell phone, how long does it take the brain to go back to normal? So which question do you think I want to jump into?
I don't know which one you want. I know that I think I'd like them all answered.
Me too. I do want them all, but I don't have all of the time of the world. So I have to make a decision of which one we're going to go next.
Well, and you have to decide what kind of money we can spend on that.
That's absolutely correct, all means.
So can you stay with us a few more minutes?
Yes, sir.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Nora Volkow, who is working over there very hard at figuring out where the cell phones are, what they're doing in our brains. She's head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH. One question for you, and then we'll get one from our audience. Why is the drug abuse division of NIH looking at cell phones?
Well, I'm an investigator, and so I've been studying the effects of drugs in the human brain for all of my professional career. And one of the technologies that we use in order to do so is magnetic resonance imaging. And magnetic resonance imaging, of course, relies on very potent magnets, stationary as well as fluctuating magnets. And I've been interested specifically to the question, do these magnetic fields affect the function of the brain? Is the instrument that we are using by itself affecting brain function? In a technology, we are trying to extract information directly about brain function. So for the past 15 years, we've been investigating the effects of magnetic radiation and exposure into brain metabolic activity. And we've shown, this was a recent study, that when we did place the subjects in the magnet and we used the gradient coils, which are shifting gradients back, magnetic fields back and forth, we produce a significant change in brain glucose metabolism. And so when we had those results, immediately the question that emerged is, if that is the case, could there also be an effect from exposure to the electromagnetic radiation from cell phones? So we came at it very indirectly by trying to understand whether the tools that we were using to study the human brain by themselves could affect functional signals. And we did document that shifts in magnetic fields can produce, evidently by producing electrical gradients and electrical currents in the brain, which after all, cells communicate with one another by passing electrical currents. Because we showed that it could affect brain glucose metabolism, then that led to that question, well, what about cell phones?
Well, it looks like you took the initiative on this thing. So where will you go next?
Well, I'm starting from substance use disorders, trying to understand how they affect the brain, and now I'm faced with this finding, which always happens when you do research. You start with one question, and you end up with many more questions. But of the questions that I'm most interested in is trying to figure out if there is a design that we can do realistically, that will not be incredibly expensive, that can address that very important question. Are there long-lasting consequences from exposure to these weak signals of electromagnetic radiation? I'd like to be able to answer that question in a way that is comprehensive and provides information that is useful.
We welcome your results, Dr. Volkov, when you finish that study.
Yeah, me too. It's not simple. Experimentally, as I say, it's going to be...
Well, maybe you should get the cell phone companies to pitch in with you here.
No, it will be conflict of interest.
Yeah. The drug companies always study the drugs, right?
They do, but it's also very unclear. That has generated a lot of controversy of whether a study that is funded by a company that's producing that drug is as credible as one that is not funded by them, but it's completely independent.
I hear you. I hear you. Well, we'll be rooting for you.
Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Volkov.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Nora Volkov is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH, and we'll see how far she can get in finding out how persistent those changes in the brain are. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. It's not uncommon to hear people talk about having an out-of-body experience where, you know, they view themselves from outside their own body looking back at themselves. And my next guest says he has found a way of creating just such an experience in people, where people seem to connect to an image and react to it as if it's real, but outside their own body. And in further studies, he has people believe that they have an extra third arm through the power of illusions. But it is not just a parlor trick. The research, he says, can help us understand how we perceive ourselves and make sense of the world around us. And I think I think it might lead to some new online social communities. We'll ask him about it. He's Henrik Ehrensson, an associate professor of cognitive neuroscience at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And he's one of the authors of a paper this week in the journal Public Library of Science Online, in which people were made to believe they had a third arm. Welcome to Science Friday, and thank you for your patience.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about this out-of-body experience. How did you create that for people?
Well, we're interested in how the brain creates the experience of the self and the world. So we were trying to learn more about this. We came up with this idea that maybe we could trick the mind into experience being outside oneself. And how did we do that, did you ask?
Yes.
Well, the idea here is really that we are trying to manipulate the sensory data the brain gets. We manipulate what you see, what you feel, and we touch your body in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a camera that people can look through it themselves?
Well, there's two key ideas here, really. First of all, it's the visual perspective, from which perspective you see the world.
Right.
And then it is that what you see and what you feel matches, so there's synchronicity.
I see.
Visual information and tactile information. So how does this all work? Like, I'm going to try to explain to you, over the radio here without the aid of visuals. But so the test person wears a set of head-mounted displays. Mm-hmm. Head-mounted displays is two little screens you put in front of the right and the left eye. And these two screens we hook up to two video cameras that we place a couple of meters away from the participant. So the left eye sees what the left camera sees, and the right eye sees what the right camera sees. So you can see yourself from the outside, okay?
Right, right.
Now, that doesn't create an out-of-body illusion or an out-of-body experience. You just look at yourself from an outside perspective. A little bit like you see yourself in the video screen as, a CCTV camera in a shop, for example, Now, here's the second key thing. I then move my hand towards the cameras. I touch a point just below the cameras. And every time I do that, we deliver a touch on the person's chest, on the person's body, which he or she can't see. Right?
Yeah.
So all you see yourself sitting in the middle of the room from this outside perspective, and you see the scientist's hand coming up towards the cameras. And every time you see that hand coming up towards the cameras, you feel touching your body. Now, this is what happens. Suddenly you experience that you are there under the cameras. You can sense your body there. And although you see yourself, and you perfectly well understand that you're still sitting there in front of the cameras, you can see yourself, it feels like a different person, or maybe a mannequin. Because your brain have now recomputed, recalculated, your position in that room, and you feel that you're outside your body, and so you lose a sense of, self-recognition of real physical body.
So you think it's someone else's body, but you feel part of it.
Now you lose the sense of feeling. You don't feel part of it anymore. Uh-huh. You feel that you are 2 meters outside yourself. And the real body that you can see, it feels like someone else. You're no longer part of it.
And so can you play tricks with it and make you actually feel like you are having an out-of-body experience?
Well, we are simulating some key aspects of an out-of-body experience. First of all, that you feel that you're in a different place from your real body. Secondly, you see yourself from this outside perspective. And three, you sort of sense a phantom body. You have some kind of a body illusion that is outside your real body. And these are some of the key aspects of real out-of-body experience.
And in a follow-up, you're able to actually put a third arm next to the people, and they thought that was part of their own body.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a crazy experiment. But it actually it's a serious idea behind it, because we wanted to understand what are the basic and fundamental constraints of the human body experience. What can we experience as our body? The common assumption is that we have a human body our whole life. We have this lifetime of experience of having a human body with two legs, two arms, and one head. And this is something that we have in our genes. And we thought, is that the basic limit, or can we experience strange bodies as our own? And there are actually rare cases of stroke patients that after stroke to certain parts of the brain can experience an extra phantom limb, like they have a phantom arm.
And you actually put a third limb next to people and convinced them that that was their third arm.
Yeah, we were able to induce this experience of having a third arm in normal volunteers within a couple of minutes.
Wow, a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
I've seen pictures of you like stroking the arm with a brush, and people thought that they could feel that.
Yeah, we ask people sit down in front of a table and just put their hand on the table, and next to the real hand we put a rubber hand, like a realistic prosthetic hand, just next to the real hand, and we stroke the two hands synchronously for a minute or so. And the person can see both hands. And, of course, in the beginning, it's kind of silly. You can see your hand lying there being stroked. You don't feel anything. But after about 30 seconds or so, most participants have this very, very weird sensation that they feel touches on both hands. And they actually feel that both the real hand and the rubber hand are sort of both part of the body, like they have a third arm.
Wow. And how long does that last for? I mean, as long as they're looking and stroking it. They don't feel like missing when they get up from the table. They don't have the phantom limb missing.
No, when you stand up and you start moving, the illusion breaks down very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So where do you go from here with this?
Well, we're really interested in developing new advanced prosthetic limbs. There's a lot of interest in that in Europe and in America, I know. And what we try to do is try to help out working with robotics people and engineers to develop artificial limbs that feels more like part of your real body.
Right.
Less like a tool and more like a real limb. And we think that one way we can contribute to this development is to use these illusions for something good, to actually sort of trick the brain into accepting these prosthetic limb devices as part of the real body.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you. It's great being here.
You're welcome.
Chatting with you.
Henrik Ehrsson is an associate professor of cognitive neuroscience at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Up now, Flora Vlickman is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Video pick of the week. What have you got for us today?
Well, we were just talking about illusions, a big illusion, mm-hmm. right? Well, it turns out that our eyes and our visual system do sort of more minor illusions all day long. So the video pick of the week this week is about what our eyes see and how that's different from what we perceive.
What we see being different from what we perceive.
Right.
A fine difference?
Let me give you an example.
Okay, good idea.
So our eyes move over 100,000 times per day, these rapid eye movements. More than 3 times a second, we're moving our eyes around. In fact, if you look at someone, if you look into the person's eyes next to you, for example, you'll notice that their eyes are not staying still.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're moving your eyes all this time, but you notice that life is not so blurry.
It's not blurry. It's not like you see on TV when they pan the camera too quickly, right?
That's right. So our eyes are not working like a camera pan. We tune out that pan. So that's one sort of illusion that we do. But Martin Rolfe is interested in another question, which is, you know, how do you keep track of things in your eye when you're moving around so much?
Right.
And so one thing that he knows is that when your eye stops moving, you refresh the image on the back of the eye. And in fact, there's some news you can use in here. Martin Rolfe has this news you can use about how to tell if you're dreaming or awake.
And that's actually how you can tell imagery from a real visual experience, because if you move your eyes, things change on the retina. If you move your eyes while you're imagining, while you're hallucinating, nothing changes. So if you want to know if you're dreaming or not, you should just move your eyes or your body.
So there, instead, forget the pinch test. Do the retina test.
And so your video pick of the week, we're going to see what.
So in this, we look at Rolfe's study where he tracks our eyeballs. He puts people in front of a high-speed camera, and he has this software that'll follow your eyeballs around. So that's kind of, first of all, kind of cool to see.
That's cool.
And what he finds is that our attention, our eyes move all the time, and it seems like our visual system is sort of prepared for this movement. Almost like our part of our brain knows where our eyes are going to move before they move.
It anticipates?
It anticipates the movement.
And so it moves the visual field in advance of where we think we're going to be going?
Right. I mean, if you hold your finger, your thumb in front of your eyes, and you move your eyes around, you notice that your thumb's going to change position in the visual field. This happens all the time. So to keep your attention on your thumb, your visual system prepares for that movement in a fraction of a second before the movement happens. So you start paying attention to where your thumb's going to be after the movement takes place, before the movement happens. Mm-hmm. It's complicated.
but you show it very well. That's why we have visuals.
That's why we have visuals.
If you go to our video pick of the week on our webpage at sciencefriday.com, you'll see Flora's video pick of the week where she shows exactly how your eye anticipates.
Yes, I threw in a lemur because I figured there needs to be some enticing thing to get people to watch this.
Get a critter in there whenever
we
can. And so he studies this. This is what he does for a living. He studies how we look at things.
These rapid eye movements are kind of interesting. I asked if you could look into someone's eyes and tell where they're paying attention, and he said there are these micro saccades, these really tiny eye movements that are sort of correlated to attention. So if you're at a party, you're at a cocktail party, and you're trying to gauge the person's interest that you're talking to, you'd have to look very closely to tell whether they're interested. But if you see their eyes darting off all the time to the side, that's a pretty good indicator that it's not going well.
Yeah, especially if they're darting toward their watch.
Yeah.
All right, Flora. Thank you, Flora's video pick of the week is up there at sciencefriday.com. It's on our website, and just click on the video on the left side. We'll also give you links on our webpage and on our Facebook page. You'll be able to link to the video. We have our Facebook page at Facebook.com/SciFry. We invite you to go there. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.